Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show whenever you want to hear it, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Teresa Cardenas about a new flamenco performance that's coming up. Right now, I would like to welcome, this is the first Wednesday of the month, Bill Hutchison is with us from the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society.
Hello, Mary Charlotte.
Hello, Bill. It's great to have you back.
Thank
and Dwayne
you.
Adams, who is the executive director of this wonderful organization, joins us as well.
Hi, Mary Charlotte.
And I would like to say, and we'll say this again at the end, this is the last time that we're going to do the first Wednesday of the month. We are now going to the first Friday of the month to accommodate schedules. And so if you are addicted to the animal show, that's... mark it on your calendars. The you have something coming up in August, which is the New Mexico State Humane Conference. What is a humane conference?
The humane conference is something we started about 3 years ago. This is our third year doing this. And it's the opportunity to bring some of the national speakers in the humane work to a local venue like New Mexico. Many of the shelters around New Mexico have a tough time going to the national conferences, where they're held in usually Florida or Las Vegas, Nevada. And this gives them the opportunity to hear the same speakers and to learn what's going on in the national scene, but not have to travel too far. So their travel costs are very minimal. Most time they don't have to have hotel rooms, and they can make a day trip of it. We did the first one in Albuquerque back in 2006. Last year we had it in Santa Fe. And this year we're back in Albuquerque.
And there's nothing like this in the state before. And there are other states throughout the country that have these kind of conferences, and they're really valuable, not just for the people to learn, but also to meet each other, to network, and it's nice to know you're not alone.
The networking is definitely one of the premier things about the conference, gives people the opportunity to find out that they're not alone out there, and problems they're having at their shelter are very similar to what other people are having, and how we can all work together to make this state the best state possible for the animals.
So there's a lot of things that people have to deal with. You here in New Mexico, I mean in Santa Fe, have a large and well-run and established animal shelter. In other parts of the state, there are people with very small, just barely making ends meet animal shelters.
Well, if they have a shelter at all, I mean, yeah. There's a lot of communities that don't even have a shelter. The animal welfare is being provided from foster parents and foster-based organizations that hope to someday have a shelter. And that's it. With the conference, we really tried to put a whole mix of classes together from startup organizations. I mean, if you look at the classes this year, we have a lot of classes put on for volunteers, how to work with volunteers, how to start an organization from scratch, how to do strategic planning. All the way up to on the second day, we're really proud that this year we've partnered up with UC Davis out of California, and they're going to be here putting on a full day of animal shelter medicine. It's a shelter medicine track because some of the medical needs of the animals in a shelter are very unique to shelters. I mean, we have to worry
about... For example?
We have to deal with what they call herd management. When you have an upper respiratory infection, which shelters get continuously, you're constantly being infected with these different diseases. And dealing with those is very difficult. It's not like at your home where your animal doesn't have stress. You can give him some medication, maybe some antibiotics, and he's going to get over it. With the shelters, there's a lot of stress involved for the animals. We try to make it as best possible. But, combating something like upper respiratory, well, you have one cat that has an upper respiratory infection is one thing. Now take that and multiply it by 100 cats. And all of a sudden, this gets really tough to get rid of it. Just when you start getting control of it, it comes back. So shelters are constantly having to find new ways to combat these diseases, and that's what they're going to do, is they're going to spend a full day talking to shelter workers, medical professionals, about what the newest trends are, what the latest disinfectants are, what the latest diseases are that are affecting these shelters.
I would think that there's at least some cases like that where the simple fix is the most effective, like good disinfectants or washing your hands.
Bleach is a wonderful thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's like with kids. What you deal with your kid at home when they have a runny nose is very different than if you're a preschool administrator and you've got 40 kids that you deal with. When we do tours for little kids, that's definitely the quickest way they get it. because everybody knows that. Everybody has seen the one kid wipe his nose on the back of the hand, and you look across the room and you realize everybody's going to be wiping their nose. How on earth do you deal with it? And for us, it really is a matter of keeping them alive and safe and healthy. Everybody needs to know how to do this.
And one of the things that's coming out that we're learning more and more about is keeping the animals healthy mentally. It plays such an important part, and that's something that's fairly new to the shelter world. I mean, I know most of us animal people who have pets, we know that if our dogs are happy, they're going to be healthier. But it's taken a while for the shelters to start to pick up on that and figure out that the better care they can give the cats in providing toys and providing what we call environment enrichment, the animals remain healthier. The old traditional shelters, you know, just aren't cutting it because
chain link and cinder block is boring.
Oh, it's boring and it's depressing, and the animals get depressed, their immune systems go down, and all of a sudden you have a lot of diseases to fight.
I think probably a rule of thumb is that they're an awful lot like us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes. Yeah, they are. It was once referred to as little people in fur suits, and I happen to agree with that.
Absolutely.
I think it was referred to in the context of your dog is not a little person in a fur suit.
My dog is.
One of the things that surprised me last year, meeting some of the people who came up from really rural shelters, and these are good folks. You know, we had folks showing up in jackets and ties, and we had folks showing up in T-shirts and bibles. I mean, this is a widespread state for the needs of its animal people. But to see the look on somebody's face when they realize, you mean we're not the only ones who are dealing with this problem with, you know, a lot of cats who may get sick or a whole lot of unaltered pit bulls that come into that shelter. You know, we in Santa Fe were fortunate enough to be big and in touch with a lot of people. But these folks who are separated, that feeling of knowing that other people have experienced this, so you're not alone there, but there are actually answers to this or at least some different approaches that you can try, the relief, the breathing room that gives people to know that there is some light, that other people have experienced this, that there's information you can share. It's a huge world of difference. It can be exhausting work if you feel like you're alone and abandoned.
Yeah, and trying to implement abstinence-only programs.
Yes, absolutely. The dogs and cats are not listening. Abstinence-only is ineffective with dogs and cats.
They're just like us.
Exactly.
So, the keynote speaker, Wayne Pacelli, is from the Humane Society of the United States, and his keynote speech is called The Moral Underpinnings of Animal Protection and a Call to Action. Now, the moral underpinnings, talk about that.
I can't actually talk to that because I haven't heard the speech yet.
Interesting.
I'm looking forward to hearing about it. Bill might be able to help us a little with that.
Wayne is an interesting guy. Dwayne and I were talking about this a couple of days ago. There was a story that came out in the Washington Post, and Wayne Pacelli keeps a blog on the Humane Society website, hsus.org. And he is he surprises me sometimes because he takes things, we get locked into a certain way of thinking. And all of a sudden, you need a person who can turn a corner for you. And certainly, some of the things that he said are not the things that I would have expected an animal welfare person to say. And I can't think of a great example. But he's a smart guy. And I think, you know, Dwayne and I spend a lot of time talking about the philosophical underpinnings of what we do. And there are a lot. It's not just as simple as saving animals. What does saving animals mean to the animals, to a community? Every community is different. What does this say about us as a species? And there are these really fascinating questions when you start to get into it. And it's not that these are airy questions that you talk about instead of doing the real work of saving animals. This is a real part of the real work of saving animals, the ideas and the motivations behind it. And I suspect that's something that, certainly in reading his other stuff, that's been important to him, and I hope it's part of what he brings to our workshops.
I think there's another issue, which is part of all this, which is that the animal shelter Humane Society work is very stressful for the human beings doing it, and it's relentlessly so.
Yes, absolutely.
The new thing that they've started talking about is called compassion fatigue, and it seems to be plaguing the animal shelter workers that people have worked for a couple years really hard and put everything they have into it, and they're getting burnt out because they're feeling like they're not making any difference. And being a person who's been in the animal welfare movement for 25 years, you know, it's easy for me to see a difference because I can span back over 25 years and I can truly see that the things are really changing and dramatically. But if you come into the movement and you feel like you're going to work hard for a year or two and you're going to get on top of things and you're going to see major changes, you're probably going to get very disappointed, burnt out, and have this thing they call compassion fatigue. I don't know. I probably had that at one point in my life, but I forgot about it.
And you just got recompassionized.
You just keep going right through it.
Yeah.
When you say that you have seen a lot of changes over the 25 years that you've been doing the work, what?
Well, some of the things I can point out to people that I'm sure everyone has seen. You know, if you think back 20, 25 years ago, and you're on the road, you're traveling across country, and you're going to pull into rest areas and so forth, you rarely would see anybody traveling with their pet. You saw cars pulling in, people going to the restroom. Now try to find a rest area that doesn't have a potty area for the pets. You know, take a look at the people coming into the rest areas. They all have their dogs with them. Some people are starting to travel with their cats. Not something I recommend. The cats especially do not recommend it. But you know,
that falls into the you get what you deserve category.
The whole concept of the way people are caring about their animals is truly changing. It used to be, you know, back when I was growing up, animals or dogs were rarely left in the house. And today, I mean, I can't imagine telling my dogs they can't come in the house. And many of my friends, you go to my friend's house, their dogs are running around their house. And it may just be I have wacky friends, or it may be that society is actually changing the view they have on animals.
Well, I think there's a lot more discussion about it, you know, not only through radio programs like this, but everywhere. I mean, I was just thinking the other day about how when I was growing up, I had a wonderful dog named Taffy. And we never walked her. We let her run around in her pen, which was big, but dogs need
walks.
That
was where she lived, absolutely.
She lived in the pen. She lived in the house. We were nice to her, but she didn't live nearly as happy a life as she could have had we known a few things. And at that point, nobody knew those things. Yeah. Nobody did anything different from what we did. So not only were we ignorant, but we didn't even know that there were alternatives or that we were supposed to think about alternatives.
Right. We talk about things that crop up in the news a lot, and I was realizing the other day more and more domestic animal welfare issues show up in the news, and that's a barometer. Not just, I mean, it's always been something you could build a little conflict out of and get some good media out of, but more and more, this is what people are interested in. So this is what the media provides, information. And we, you know, sometimes we look at these stories that crop up, and you think, this is, in the animal welfare world, this may not be a huge story, but to people who don't understand, it is, and people actually give a damn about it now, and it makes a huge difference in what people get reported back to them. That's fascinating.
20 years ago, would Three Dog Bakery have made it? You know, 20 years ago, could you buy beer for your dog? You know, they have that special canine beer now.
What?
Oh, yeah, all these things are happening, which I think is great. It's just people's
canine
awareness.
Canine beer?
Yeah, canine
What's that?
Beer. It's a beer brewed specifically for dogs.
Do they get a buzz on?
No, it's got no alcoholic content to it. I don't know. I've never tried it.
It's part of the movement to make them little people. They really, I mean, they're a part of our lives. They're a part of our daily lives. I remember growing up not that long ago when there were inside dogs and outside dogs. Now, I mean, I just can't imagine having an inside. There's just your dog and your dog's wherever you are. And if you're outside, that's where
indoor,
your dog
outdoor
is.
Dog.
Exactly. But the idea of having, you know, we had pasture and we had a dog who only lived outside and didn't think anything of it. And now that's just such a world away, it seems, and it's only a few years.
Yeah, and, you know, I would think that under certain circumstances, an outdoor dog would be a very happy dog if it had a warm enough place to sleep and had a job. I mean, the thing that makes our dogs unhappy now is that they don't have enough work to do.
And they're social creatures. They need the interaction. They need their people. That's just a part of it. It has to be a part of their lives.
Yeah, and I mean, if you've got terriers or if you've got another working breed, they don't, I mean, some dogs, like my little dachshund, would be happy to cuddle up all day, take one little walk, eat, sleep, and watch television. But, you know, terriers.
You could say an Australian cattle dog who was born to herd some cattle, they're not going to be as into cuddling 24/7.
No, they won't.
I think behavior departments are also very different than they used to be. I mean, even in my brief tenure in animal welfare, in 5 years, the number of shelters that have behavior departments now that are really concerned not just with, we have a dog that needs a home, we have a dog or a cat, let's learn about this animal's personality so that we can find the most suitable match for it. I mean, we've gone from saving, just being fixated on saving lives to saving lives in the best and most appropriate ways possible. That's very exciting for people in animal welfare.
Yeah, I know that's definitely one of the things Wayne plans on addressing is when you talk about adoption, and Bill's absolutely right. We spend more and more of our resources now trying to learn as much as we can about the animals and make sure we get the proper placement and trying to make sure that people are going to have a really good experience with this pet and the pet's going to have a good experience. And sometimes shelters are taking that to an extreme and they're trying to be so careful about their placements that they're not placing their animals they're always looking for that perfect home. And, you know, I don't know that a perfect home exists. There's definitely good homes and better homes. And we're trying to do the best we can. I know that's something that that Wayne's been plagued with a lot lately, the question of what is an appropriate adoption screening process. So he plans on addressing that.
That's what that story we were talking about earlier was actually about. There was a story that ran in the Washington Post. It was a pretty in-depth story about national shelters and their approaches to adoption. And he really responded to it. And that's what surprised me. He basically seemed to advocate, find the animal a reasonably good home. You cannot find A-plus homes for every animal. And even at the shelter, I'm hyper aware of the fact that my home is not an A-plus home. I'm gone 8, 9, 10 hours a day. My dogs are all by themselves. It's not ideal. But this is the real world. I would prefer not to be gone 8 or 10 hours a day, but it's what puts my and their food on tables and bowls. So it's, if you encounter the world as it really is, then you have a better chance of making it the way you hope it'll be, rather than trying to pretend the world is other than it is.
And also, I mean, there, I would think, be some lower-level screening things, like you won't adopt a dog out to people who are going to make it fight or...
Oh, God, no.
Or yeah. Other, you know, or keep it on a chain.
Absolutely.
You never want to place an animal in potentially harm's way. I mean, you don't want anything wrong to happen to it. But, yeah, one of the things, thinking back about talking about what things have changed and what we deal with now with our animals, I mean, my dog, for instance... You know, does sleep in the bed with me. He's everywhere with me. And I think that that's making him a happy dog. I do it because I enjoy it, and he loves it. Maybe he doesn't, but
does
I know that
he... Does he have a seat at the dining table?
Well, I don't ever eat at the dining table, but he does have his own lounger. But I think the point for me is, you know, who knows that maybe he would be happier being outside and so forth, but I know he's definitely enriching my life by being with me and being with me all the time in my house, so...
Yeah.
I like to think of it as a win-win.
And the reality is we learn from our animals. If we place, say my home is a B-minus home, I certainly think when I started at the shelter, my home was probably a B-minus, C-plus home for an animal. But just the experience of interacting with and sharing a life with an animal, absolutely. I mean, any person who's got a cat or a dog or anything can attest to the fact that it's an absolute fact. They change your life. They teach you about how to be a better human being. And putting an animal into a B-minus home, that's not a B-minus home in the long run. I think our hope, and you know, who knows how it always plays out, but the hope and often the reality is, it's a transformative experience to take the responsibility for a new life. And if they've made the decision, one of the interesting things about the shelter is that when they come into the shelter, when a potential adopter comes in, that's our first experience with them. But for them, very often, this may have started 2 or 3 weeks ago, when he says, we need a dog, we should get a dog. And she says, really, do you think so? And they talk about it, and they plan about it, and they eventually decide, well, we'll go to the shelter, and then they walk in our door, and they've had this whole long experience. So if we can say, look, you know, here's some realities about your lifestyle and this dog, but we want you to try. Here's what you can expect. Here's what you can do to make this dog happier. It's very exciting to see people wake up in the face of all this responsibility. And that's a great thing for us to take on as shelters.
What is the one popular saying, I wish I was half as good a human as my dog thinks I am?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
That is so very true. When I first moved to New Mexico in the early 90s, one of the things I was struck by was how many days in the month there was an animal story on the front page of the daily paper.
Yeah.
This is an unusual place.
It is. It is, absolutely. But it, as unusual as Santa Fe is, the country is definitely waking up to animal welfare issues, and it's very interesting to see. I mean, we've seen a lot more in the news lately, stuff to do with farm animals, you know, the downer cows, or how animals are treated in factory farming situations. For a long time, most folks in this country just didn't care where their eggs or chicken or beef came from. But now HBO is airing special documentaries on how poor animals are treated in factory farming situations. The Farm Sanctuary now, it's a subset of HSUS now, isn't it?
Yes, yeah, Farm Sanctuary.
Farm Sanctuary. And there, so the Humane Society of the United States, one of the paramount animal welfare organizations, has taken on this, because there's really no separation when we start to think about it. You know, how we want our dogs and our cats to be treated really well. So why would we ask any different for pigs and chickens and cows? No, we don't want suffering for any living creature. And it's fascinating to see the the psychological barometer of this country start to shift to understand that, yes, indeed, they do have feelings and make choices and like one thing better than another, just like us.
Do people make the connections between, the humane work that you're doing and then things like prisoners' rights work?
It's really hard, I think. I think there are definitely some people that do, but one of the things I've noticed about any, especially in a nonprofit town like this, and this is my own personal observation, Duane may disagree, but we get really sunk into our causes sometimes and forget. In fact, this is a point Duane's been making at the shelter. You forget how interrelated all these things are. You know, you learn one little thing about animal welfare, and all of a sudden it's not animal welfare. This is applicable to your whole life, to the way we interact with the world around us. So I think the movements of even, say, animal welfare advocates who are primarily concerned with dogs and cats also saying, wait, how are our cows being treated in this country? I think this is starting to realize that everything is linked together.
And as we've discussed before, I think on this program, there is a connection between, for example, people who abuse animals and domestic violence.
Big time.
Yeah, they call that the link. And yeah, they're finding it, more and more they're finding that all these troubled people, criminals who have done some really heinous things, started out abusing animals. And they're figuring out that if they catch things early on, they have a better chance of changing that. But
there was a good paper I read that a study that came out in the late 90s, and they quoted one of the researchers as saying, not every person who abuses animals will grow up to be a serial killer, but almost every violent offender or really person who commits really terrible crimes, almost everyone abused animals in their youth. It's amazing. And there are over 50 studies, I think I counted 54 that I could find since 1950, between 1950 and 2005 when I counted, that directly link domestic violence and animal abuse. So this is not like when global warming is it or isn't happening. There are 50 years worth of academic studies saying it's absolutely real. So everything we do for animal welfare, everything Esperanza Battered Women's Shelter does for victims of domestic violence, every nonprofit that works for the good, for social well-being in this town, we're all working for essentially the same, to treat the same set of issues in our country.
Which is essentially compassion.
Be kind. Be decent to each other. There's an easier way of doing things than the combative way.
On that note, it's time to go. Duane Adams is the executive director of the Santa Fe Animal Shelter and Humane Society, and Bill Hutchison is also with that wonderful organization, and they can be reached at the telephone number
983-4309. All our adoptable animals are on our website, updated hourly at www.sfhumanesociety.org.
Hey, do you have any animals to tell us about?
Oh, two awesome animals. You know, we have a really great second chance program, because while not every home is an A-plus home, not every animal is an A-plus animal, mine included. And two that we have right now who are great, great, great animals that need a special home are Sarah, who's a 1.5-year-old Rottweiler mix. Very sweet, but very shy, gentle. She needs somebody who's willing to give her a quiet home, some training classes to build some confidence, and be a really solid, trustworthy owner for her. And Jerry, who's one of our special cats, he's in our Gabriel Angels program, which is they just need a little bit of special attention. He's a 5-year-old black, short-haired cat. And he's a great cat. You'd never know he has any issues until you try to stop petting him. And then all of a sudden, he's really
Don't stop.
Yeah, absolutely. He may whack you a couple times to let you know that you need to keep going.
So for those who have a more sedentary lifestyle,
I got two perfect animals for you. Call the shelter, meet Sarah and Jerry. They're superb, superb critters.
Duane and Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
And we will see you next month and the first Friday of the month instead of the first Wednesday.
People should tune in on Wednesday because they're Mary Charlotte addicts. And then just catch the animal show by the by on Friday.
There we have it, ladies
and
gentlemen.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
All right, we're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like to welcome Teresa Cardenas. She, in association with Maria Benitez and the Institute for Spanish Arts, is presenting a flamenco performance called El Pintor, starting on the 3rd of July, Thursday, and continuing nightly, except Mondays, through the 23rd of July at 8 o'clock at the Lodge of Santa Fe. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. So this is a performance called El Pintor. Who was El Pintor? Julio Romero Torres.
Right. This is actually...
El Pintor means the painter.
Right, exactly, in Spanish. It's a dance drama. It's a flamenco dance drama. So it has sort of a modernistic twist to it to be able to present the paintings of this very famous painter in the south of Spain, called Julio Romero de Torres. And people in America really, unless you're in flamenco, you don't really know who this painter is. But he was a very prolific painter, between the late 1800s, early 1900s. He had sort of a style, a very different style, that really focused on women. So he sort of profiled women. He was very much in love with the Andalusian woman and, you know, what she was all about. So most of all of his paintings are really about these women. So what I did is I drew from one of his paintings that I just fell in love with, that most people know in Spain. And the name of the painting, very famous painting, was called La Chiquita Piconera, which means the little coal girl. So that particular individual was his most prized model, and he didn't really paint her until the very end of his career. So he just sort of become, intoxicated with her. So this show is about that woman, that intoxication that he had with her.
Now, when you say very few people outside of flamenco have heard of this painter, is he associated with flamenco?
He is, because he painted, that was his subject, was flamenco. It wasn't, all of his subject. He had, other kinds of things he did, like, lots of portraits and, a very wealthy people in the community of Cordoba where he lived.
So it's interesting, because when I think of flamenco, and I haven't seen all that much flamenco, I don't necessarily always think of like a storytelling ballet where a drama is being told. But this really is that.
Yeah, it's really it's a drama. It has a beginning and an ending, and it's really about him sort of discovering what she's all about, and it's about really giving her voice. And she didn't have that voice because she was only 14 years old when he painted her. And he painted her for about 4 years. And then in 1930, when he finally, produced, her, he died. So that was his really sort of visionary painting. It was an idealized painting, so that sort of meant that it wasn't really her. It was in his mind. It's a very sensuous, picture. You wouldn't think that she was, at the time, 16 years old.
Right.
So this story is really about that, and how she didn't really have a voice in how that painting was going to really come out.
Right. It's such an interesting relationship that happens throughout the history of art, particularly Western art, which is that relationship between the painter and the subject, which is often a male and a female.
Exactly. Now, the community, after he died and then the painting was presented, it was sort of scandalous. I mean, people gossiped about her. They wanted to know more, as to what happened during that time that he painted her.
Yeah.
People thought she was a prostitute. And I actually did find out. I did some research on her, and she survived. She lived on. She died at 97. She died 2 years ago. And
she died at the age of 97?
Yeah. So she actually had, a time in her life where she had to defend herself all the time, from gossip.
Now, just so we know, the painter, Julio Romero de Torres, died in 1930?
He died in 19... Right. That's right.
So she had a long, long life beyond it. So, and
was her life after that really defined by that? It was defined by that, clearly.
So interesting.
Clearly. So I just admired her that she stayed in her community and defended herself. So she overcame, you know, all of the, you know, whatever people had to say about her. But at the same time, she had this, finally finished her, he created sort of an immortal woman. So he gave her her immortality. So she really spent most of her life as this, you know, very interesting woman on the painting. So she was an interesting person.
On the back of the disc, El Pintor, which we're listening to in the background, there is a quotation in Spanish, and the English translation is that in the paintings of this painter, Julio Romero de Torres, the women are not only beautiful, but they have this look of depth and sadness, full of sensuality, love, and pain. That seems like a great description of flamenco.
It is. So we use we use imagery so that people understand, you know, what his paintings were all about. So we have these scenes where we imitate or we try and bring out the meaning of that painting. So there's different emotions that, you know, these women. We have three women on stage, three dancers, and they all sort of portray different parts of her personality. So it's this three women in one, you know, that make, and at the end, you know, she becomes this really incredible whole person.
How are the paintings represented on the stage of the flamenco performance?
They're projected on a scrim, like a black scrim, in the back of the stage.
And so, and they change because there's a lot of paintings.
He has a huge collection of paintings. His body of work is incredible. We couldn't obviously use all of them, so I selected the ones that were best suited the emotions of those women that are on the stage trying to sort of paint the picture of, you know, of her personality.
Now, you are from New Mexico.
I am.
Going generations back.
I am.
How did you get into flamenco?
Oh, my goodness. Maybe started in 1930. My mother was a classical Spanish dancer. She had a dance studio. And she studied flamenco in San Francisco.
Now, is there a connection that goes way back? I mean, we are, you know, this is a Spanish town back to the 17th century or earlier, whatever. Is there a dance connection that goes back that far or not so much?
You know, it's hard to trace back the Spanish dance because it's changed, or the flamenco in itself has evolved. But Spanish dance, you know, has evolved, you know, as well. I think that maybe back in like the 1920s, there were forms of the dance that arrived, and you know, there are many old dances like fandango, and you know, that might have been here, and maybe other dancers coming from other parts of the country, you know, for a short period of time. But I know that for my mother, you know, she took dance with a woman that was trained out of Denver, and there was one from New York, and you know, there's sort of a, you know, there's a few dancers that sort of hung around for about 20-30 years. But the flamenco, I give credit to Maria Benitez, because really she's the one who sort of set the stage in northern New Mexico. She's my mentor. She's also the founder of the Institute for Spanish Arts, she and her husband Cecilio. So she's got a dance studio. She teaches, you know, young girls. So, you know, that's really where you begin to learn the dance. You learn classical dances when you're young, and then you grow into flamenco.
Interesting.
Because you need those forms when you're younger in order to really understand flamenco. Because flamenco's, you know, it's a very emotional dance. So you have to develop, you know, your body needs to develop, your mind needs to develop.
That's such an interesting aspect of flamenco, because you might say that that's not as much true of ballet or something like that, which has so much athleticism and kind of weightless perfection in it. It's not as much about the depth of emotion that flamenco has.
It has so much depth. Now, Maria went to Spain. That's where she studied. And that brought us a whole world of what I call sustainability. So we can sustain now our artists, because when she brought them here, she gave them jobs. And, you know, they were able to bring other people here from Spain, and she just kept that tradition going, and that's what really created the community, the flamenco community, was that, you know, that exchange between Spain and here, and she was the one who kept it going.
Have you studied in Spain yourself?
I have, yes.
What
I
do
have.
You learn in Spain that you might not be able to learn here?
Spain is an interesting place because it's so international. And it has many Latin influences. So, you know, if you go to the very south of Spain, you might learn a different style there, and you go to Madrid and you learn another style there. So it's nice to be able to have both, like study different places in Spain. Don't just study in one city or with one teacher. You pick up your library of dance really from studying with different teachers.
We're talking to Teresa Cárdenas, and the opening of El Pintor is Thursday, the 3rd of July. It continues nightly, except for Mondays, through the 23rd of July at the Lodge of Santa Fe. Now, that's an intense schedule. 6 nights a week.
Yeah, 18 nights. 18 nights. So it's come twice, because you'll see different scenes that you want to see again.
And they won't be the same the second time.
Exactly, because it's about their emotions, and the dancers might be, you know, dancing differently that night. I mean, same choreography, but it has some freedom in it, so it has that sort of modernistic twist. So it has a little bit of modern dance.
Yeah, I was going to say, are you doing pure classical flamenco, whatever that might be? And as you just said, there's variation even within Spain, but...
We're doing primarily the flamenco, the traditional flamenco, set to, you know, the rhythms that we produced in the, you know, in the CD called El Pintor, which, by the way, was all produced in Madrid. We did all of the music there. That was done first. That's how we set the story, was really through the music.
But some of the artists doing the music are from here.
And are from here, right. Calvin Hazen from Taos,
right,
is the composer. And he's with us to, you know, really be the music director and put that all together.
And he'll be playing live?
And he'll be playing live. Let's see, we have Ricardo Anglada, and he is from Albuquerque, and lives, he actually does a lot of work with the American Flamenco Repertory Company in Albuquerque. We have Vicente Griego, who's also from northern New Mexico, and he's arcante, so he'll be, you know, one of the singers. And we also have Francisco Javier Ozorco, and he is our percussionist and singer, and he's from Barcelona, and he's one artist that Maria had brought here, and he stayed. So he's very much a teacher and a mentor to other singers and percussionists. And our dancers are Maritza Tofer, and she's actually from Arizona. She's trained there, but she moved here to study with Pablo Rodarte, who is our choreographer. Pablo's from Denver, but has spent 30 years in Spain. So he has an enormous library of, you know, of this all these pieces that you're going to see. We have Elena Osuna. She's out of Albuquerque, but she's from northern New Mexico, also trained in Spain. She works with the National Conservatory of Flamenco in Albuquerque. We have, and then our featured dancer is Adriana Manismo, and she is, actually, she's from Albuquerque, but she resides in Jerez, Spain.
Now, are you dancing?
I'm not. I'm directing.
So you directed it. Wow, what's it like for you not to be dancing?
Well, I think that when you direct, you have a different perspective. You really get into the story, and you have a chance to evaluate it and, you know, tweak it and and you're more involved really in how the audience is viewing it. When you're a dancer, you can't see it. You're in it. Your emotions are in it. So
right.
My emotions are a little bit far removed. But I also wrote the story, so it's so hard to, you know, play all these roles. So when you write, it's a gift. You write for them. You write for them, and then they give it back to the audience.
And so you had specific dancers in mind.
I did.
And the whole thing, musicians.
Yeah. Because they had to look like the woman, you know, the piconera. I call her the piconera.
What does that mean?
It means, well, it's the coal girl, little coal girl. And this woman happened to be that maid that was in the Romero house when, you know, he discovered her. So a little coal girl means, you know, during those days, there was a little pot that you'd fill up with coal. And there were only certain maids that really knew, or young women or women that knew how to tend to it, because it was used in rooms that were cold, and then you'd put your hands, you know, for the guests would come in and their hands would be cold. You know how we use space heaters?
Right, right.
This is what they did. They, you know,
and
they
she
warmed.
Was the servant who tended
yeah,
the space
servant.
Heaters,
exactly.
The coal heaters.
Exactly. It was exactly. So anyway, I had to cast people. So that's another thing that you do when you're direct. You have to cast people. So I had to carefully choose, you know, the dancer. So I chose these three women because they all had something similar, but then they were all so different.
Now, the story of the girl, was it a... I mean, you think of tragedy in the drama. Was it a tragic story?
You know, it was. It was a tragic story because I feel like she never had her voice. You know, and people were always questioning, you know, was she a prostitute or not?
Right.
They wondered that.
So it's a subtle tragedy.
Exactly.
Nobody gets their heart cut out with a dagger.
Right. It's not fair. Although maybe she felt that, and we do portray that,
yeah.
That maybe sometimes she did feel that she had no chance at freedom, you know, liberty.
Flamenco is... You might call it a strong woman's art form.
It is now. Now with, you know, with all of the talent that we have, you know, we spend a lot of time doing footwork and rhythms because we make music with our feet. We have this one featured dancer, Adriana. She has a dance called Jaleo, and it's from Jerez. It's a derivative of the Bularia. And it's a very rhythmic, it's a fun dance, but she's going to create some tension in it. So it's like, it's fun, but then there's tension. So she's doing this with her rhythm, her feet, and it's music. She has music in her mind that, you know, that she created. So the difficulty is that the guitarist and the percussionist have to work with her in order for her to execute the dance.
So it's very much of an interaction going on all the time.
It is. It's a communal dance. You cannot do flamenco by yourself. We work together as a group closely. And that's the beauty of it. And when people see it, it's so communal. And that's what they love about it. Because, you know, sometimes we lose our sense of community and we feel like, you know, pulled away from it. We're in our computers. We're, you know, driving in our cars. You know, and I think it's good to just take time to really just sit and listen and see what is a community, what does it feel like? And that's what we are. We have to create that when we work together.
And you're developing your work not only over the course of months, but really of years of working together.
Oh, absolutely. And then just think about what Maria has passed on to us. We have to carry that through, that tradition, without losing those traditions. Because flamenco can have some modernistic twist to it that could take you another direction. And we don't want to do that. Here in Santa Fe, we need to continue with our traditions.
Are there some of those modernistic twists that you see happening in Spain?
Yes. Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely.
It's interesting because I was wondering, sometimes you have an art form that continues in a more conservative and traditional manner outside of the country than inside of the country where they have their roots that they're secure about.
Exactly. Now, here in New Mexico, I think we're developing our own style also. I mean, we're picking up, we're learning from most of us, all of us have studied in Spain. But we also have people that come here, we study with them. So there's this constant exchange going on. So we're creating our own community and our own style here, I think. I think that's where it's going. And if we can do that, then that makes us better artists because we can expand on the things that we do learn from Spain.
And you're not just imitating blindly, but you've internalized it in some way that is specific to here.
And it's we have to create our own individuality in the dance. And sometimes the dance, you know, for some companies, it is like a, I don't know how to explain it, but where everybody's has the same expression, the same arm movements, the same, you know, that what you have in common is you all dance the same foot rhythms, but you have expression in your upper body, your arms and your face, so that you can show that individuality. And that takes time for a dancer to develop that. It takes years.
And I think on some level it takes suffering, which of course is what we're all trying to avoid.
In flamenco you do not avoid that. Yeah. That's something you do not avoid.
We're talking to Teresa Cárdenas, and the performance is called El Pintor. It starts on Thursday, the 3rd of July, continues nightly, except for Mondays, through the 23rd of July at 8 o'clock at the Lodge of Santa Fe, and it's in association with Maria Benitez and the Institute for Spanish Arts. Is there a phone number that people can call that if they would like more information about this? Or?
You know, they can go to my website, which is www.TeresaCardenasProductions.com.
And Teresa is T-H-E-R-E-S-A, Cárdenas.
Right.
Thank you so much, Teresa, for being on the air with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at radiocafe@ksfr.org by email or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz features the monthly Women in Jazz show, and saxophonist Virginia Mayhew will talk about her battle against breast cancer. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Ciao.